Welcome to the Dark Pedagogy podcast series. In our studio today, we have a very interesting artist and academic, Kui. And you've been doing extremely interesting projects, and there's close ties to the Dark Pedagogy project. And we'll spend the next half hour or so discussing these issues. You are our dear guest. Would you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yes, thank you for the introduction, and I've been looking forward to this as we have also been talking about it for a while, and the connection between our work, more specifically with dark pedagogy and sensuous learning, but we'll get back to that. But yes, I am Gryvor Halberg. I'm the artistic director of a performance group and movement called Sisters Hope. It is called that because it was initiated by me and my poetic twin sister. And we have, over the last decade, worked from an intention or intentions formulated in what we call the Sensuous Society Manifest. And this was written in 2008 as a response to what have become known as the financial crisis and in a response to the ongoing ecological crisis. And perhaps it's also relevant in the face of the current biological crisis that we're facing currently. But this manifest suggests a potential future world based on aesthetic premises. So that is a society governed by the sensuous and poetic. And in Sisters Academy, we are exploring what is the school of a sensuous society or learning in a sensuous society. And that's the context in which sensuous learning has developed. So yeah, so with Sisters Hope, I'm doing these different immersive interventionist and interactive performance experiments to explore different aspects of a potential future based on the aesthetic, by which we mean the sensuous and poetic. And then besides these explorations, I'm currently doing an artistic research PhD at the University of Copenhagen about my practice. And that will be done quite soon. That has been a really interesting process for me to have this time space for deep reflection as the artistic practice, even though it is also a laboratory, is also a space for production. And it has been really, I felt very spoiled to have this time space for another mode of reflection as well. Even though I argue that the reflections that I have in situ, you know, while I perform my artistic practice are very, very deep, maybe even deeper, but it's not durational. It's not a durational time for reflection, but maybe we come back to that. What else to say? I think that's it. I'm a mother of three children, twins. Yeah, I think that should cover it for now.
Perfect. As said, this is maybe one of the first episodes we're going to do together, and the idea behind it is a little bit to look into a possibility of collaboration, but also like an intellectual exchange, because we were starting to read a little bit each other's work, and then maybe there might be questions popping up. And so we look a little, maybe at both the similarities and but also the like stimulating differences in how we think about learning and education from our particular points of view, and that we're learning from and with another in this process, and today as well during this dialogue. And maybe what also might be really interesting to look at and to see is that we are coming from different foci in our work. So I, for example, from didactics, and you could come from performance art and art theory, and Jonas also from a psychological tradition, if that would be correct. And
it's okay.
It would be interesting to see how we maybe can also pull in these different perspectives during this dialogue today and after that.
Great. But I think today we would also like just, I mean, we have several questions for you, but also just continue the discussion about your perspectives on this notion of sensuous learning, but of course also reflect on linkages and overlapping perspectives with the whole dark pedagogy project that Stefan Bengtsson, who is in the room, and Jonas Lysgaard, myself. So, Stefan, jump into the questions.
Yes, so we might point out that before this meeting, we read a little bit more carefully, or to some extent, each other's work. And when reading your work, I was struck by two concepts on how you pull them in, which I would like to discuss a little bit with you today. And the first one, which I would like to have a dialogue around, is your notion of ritual, which I find quite interesting, because I understand that in your work, the ritual becomes a very creative moment also, where learning is initiated, while ritual also could be seen something as a reproduction of certain things. So my first question is then, what is the role of the ritual in your understanding of sensuous learning? And you relate it also in your writing to the discovery of many worlds around this. And if you could explain a little bit how you understand this role of the ritual and how we could discover those many worlds around us.
Yeah, so the way we use, in our reference to the ritual, it draws on van Gennep's and Turner's elaboration on the three-phased ritual process. So the three-phased ritual process has a preliminal, a liminal, and a post-liminal phase. And in the preliminal phase, you leave everyday life behind. And then there is a threshold in between the preliminal and the liminal. So you go through a threshold where you leave your in-between, and then you enter into the liminal, where the potential transformation takes place. So the whole purpose of the ritual in this theoretical thinking is to transform the person who undergoes that process. And that transformation happens during liminality, which is also defined as a betwixt and between. A place where everyday life orders are no longer dominating, but a new set of rules have not been replacing those. So it's betwixt and between. And that's where the potential transformation takes place. And then a post-liminal process of re-entering into the world, of anchoring in the experience and re-entering into the world, now transformed or potentially transformed, one could say, when it's when we talk of the artwork as a ritual as well. So I have found this process, this ritual three-phase process, very, very helpful in the design of my performances. So whenever you, as a participant, enter into a Sister's Hope performance, you will actually quite easily be able to detect that it's inspired or in resonance with these different phases. So you will find that there will be performers kind of doing initiation rituals meant at stimulating and evoking the sensuous and poetic and making you leave behind what you came from. And then, so even though 24 hours, our performances are very often 24 hours at least, is not a long time. It is within an art context. So that's, that time space is really, really important, because for the liminality to kick in, for the sense of being in a between and betwixt space where new things can emerge and happen. And then you will find that towards the end, there will be small rituals, performance initiatives to anchor the experience before you depart back into everyday life. And the anchoring rituals would focus on, okay, now you have potentially evoked and opened the sensuous and poetic space within you. How can you anchor that so that when you walk back into everyday life, it's still with you, which you could also call poetic empowerment, that it's not dependent on this particular artistic context where we have created a universe of sensuousness and poetry, but it lives within you ultimately. So we have this performance method that we call the poetic self, which is inherent poetic potential in all human beings. And potentially this is evoked in the participants. So the anchoring rituals is about holding on to that in order to integrate it into everyday life. And that also links to the intention of our work to democratize the aesthetic. And by democratizing the aesthetic, we mean to give access to the sensuous and poetic and inhabit the sensuous and poetic for as many people as possible, both within and outside the art system. And this is one reason we've gone into the educational system, because it's so impactful and formative. So if we change or integrate the premises of the sensuous and poetic in this context, it will have potentially quite wide and deep impact. And that's how sensuous, that's also an intention inherent in the sensuous learning concept. So, and then, so I guess that also in a way answers this of discovering many worlds around us. I don't know, it's also expanding the space of maneuverability. So when you become aware that this sensuous and poetic space lives within you, it's not external, it's not an add-on, it's something that is within you that you kind of awaken or unfold, give space, that kind of expands this space of maneuverability you have in the world and maybe also how you connect to the world. So currently I find it really interesting how aesthetic and ecological theory intertwines. And when I write or read the notebooks from people who have participated in Sisters Hope projects, because we give them notebooks when they enter and they donate them to our archive before departure, it's striking how many people talk about interconnectedness or feeling connected. So it evokes this deep, profound realization of the connectedness and interconnectedness of all things, which I think is really, really crucial to kind of transcend or to move into a more ecological paradigm, because at least the ecological theory I'm reading is all agreeing that this realization is very important, this thing to evoke in humans an ecology of mind, which is simply defined by understanding the deep connectivity of all things. So, yeah.
Can I just jump in here quick?
Yes.
Super interesting. I mean, thank you. Our book, Dark Pedagogy, from last year, we talk about also different states or different ways of facing what we do not understand. And we talk about denial, insanity, and death, which has a slightly different ring to it than what you were talking about. But it strikes me still that this notion of the ritual as a gateway to moving beyond or between different insights and bringing something back, that's crucial. So what are people bringing back, basically? I'm very interested in that. But then also you described this poetic self and this play sensuous learning as a very, I don't know, if not harmonic, then very, you know, safe thing to do. But in our understanding, it's also about facing things that are not necessarily safe or easily incorporated into everyday life. So, I mean, are there also, I mean, risky perspectives to this, to bringing something back?
Yeah, I think also we are called Sisters Hope. So our outset is hope. And it's also a practice for ongoingness rather than for end times. So I think this is really important in terms of, you know, that it's a practice for ongoingness in the kind of Haraway sense of the word, more than a dystopian end times, as Latour maybe would call it. So I think there is like these different paradigms within ecological thinking where we are definitely subscribing to the hopeful ones and the not only, I think, a need to attempt to create alternatives. But it's not, of course, I mean, we always represent the unknown to everyone. So when we intervene into different contexts, for example, a school or the city hall, as we did last year, we are highly risky to the people there because we represent something unknown. Even though we are very kind and very gentle and very soft. So we wouldn't define it as provocative art. You know, there is this whole tradition of provocative art. And it's very interesting because I was just doing this project with Metropolis called Walking Copenhagen, where 100 artists walk for 100 days. And we walked on the second day. And on the first day, it was this interventionist activist artist called Colonel, who is like specifically activist, like writes on thing and like addresses current political issues. And so the artistic director of Metropolis thought, I have to walk around with him because the police will be all over him. But they were not at all. They could decode it somehow. But when we walked, our poetic walk, the police was all over us because we did represent the unknown. And we were very scary, these kind of bodies walking around, undecodable. What is this? What is the intention? And we don't articulate the intention as we walk around. We insist on the mystery. And the mystery is also linked to the ritual somehow, because it's a between and betwixt space. And we don't explain. We don't explain it's based on this, we do that and that. We don't provide that subcontext necessarily. We trust the images we create in space, and we always come to represent the unknown. So, and also for the individual participants who might discover or find their poetic self, it's not necessarily harmonious, but it is for many people a very beautiful process and a process of relief when they go into it and discover this. But it's also, there's a huge, what I would call a huge post-liminal longing. So this anchoring process, we don't necessarily completely succeed, because people really need to or long to come back into our spaces to reconnect with this poetic and sensuous space within them. And they do not feel they have completely the keys to do that in everyday life at all. So this, like our intention to be independent of the spaces we create, we don't necessarily succeed in that yet. So I also have this dream of creating a permanent space, because right now there's also something with time. We work with temporary productions, manifestations, and that will always create post-liminal longing until the next manifestation occurs. So I would like the space as a space for constant belonging rather than post-liminal longing. And this constant belonging was introduced to me recently in a conversation, and I find it extremely beautiful. It was, as I understand it, first articulated by a musician called Sam André. It's a title called Sudden Bursts, Constant Belonging, but I'm interested in the constant belonging as opposed to post-liminal longing. So no, it's not just a smooth, harmonious ride. It's many different things at once.
Super interesting, because you're touching about a follow-up question that I would like to make, because you're speaking about transformation. What I hear is something very interesting, because in sustainability education, the sustainability at all, this notion of transformation is really key, but then often it's associated with a manipulation or a changing of something continuous. So it's not an abandonment or like a radical break between the before and the after. But what I hear, what you're saying also in the later part now, with that is the question of the temporality of transformation. Because what I hear saying is that it's taking place in the between. So my question to you then is, when is it in between? You know, is it synchronous temporarily with when you come back? Or because I think there's also a connection point between your work and our work, that is the question of temporality of that. You call it poetic self, and I call it future self, you know, and because I think it's really important also what that understanding of temporality might mean for how we understand learning and change and so on.
Yeah, I think it's like a space within the participants that is evoked, but that it's difficult to hold on to, even though it's inherent. So it's not like you own it not. It's not that. It's not like you had it, now you don't have it. It's there all the time, but it's kind of sleeping, it's dormant. It's like sleeping, and then it can be dormant, and then it can be kind of awoken and unfolded. And currently, I think to many, it needs those spaces, such as the ones we create, to awaken it. So how can you integrate it as a constant, as something that you really, and in my experience, it needs exercise. So that's maybe also with learning, you know, you train skills and you learn. And then at one point you really inhabit and kind of own this new skill. And even though it's not a new skill, because it was dormant, it was always there. So it's the same with the sensuous and poetic. It's always there, but to many people, because it's so underprioritized in everyday life, except if you are kind of working constantly within the art system, it's so underprioritized that you kind of need to go into these spaces to find it and to unfold it and have specific focus on it. So I think besides us, for example, creating a space for constant belonging, that's of course also why we work interventionist, because for other institutions and contexts to take serious the sensuous and poetic, for people to revisit or get a frame within which this is celebrated. And then it can become, so then over time, you know, it will grow until that person feels completely empowered by it and can carry it around and teach others as well how to get access to this bill. And so quite concretely, I see that people for whom this begins to, this transformative process in a way kind of gets inhabited into everyday life, that's also where they seek out places themselves. So in their everyday life, they walk in the city, they find spaces that have a certain acoustic underneath the bridge. Going home from work, they sit there for 10 minutes before they move on. Or they, you know, they begin to create small practices in their everyday life that evokes this space for themselves and others. So they make choices on how they structure and live so that the access to the sensuous and poetic is there, and they know how to seek it out and create it and inhabit it and prioritize it. Because everyday life doesn't necessarily prioritize it, because we are, as we both know and agree with, of course, dominated by economic rationality. So it's another set of values that kind of structures our everyday life, not the aesthetic dimension. But in our work, it is the aesthetic dimension, sensuous society. So they begin to infiltrate the logic of a sensuous society into their logic, which is currently based on economic rationality. And in that way, they also become co-movers or poetic warriors, creating these spaces for themselves and others in the midst of everyday life. And this happens, but you know, it's, yeah, as you say, it's not necessarily, I think it's both. It's both a process and it's also in a moment. So it happens in a moment within the manifestations, like, you know, like profound realizations. Not to romanticize, but we all know these kind of moments where it's kind of in one moment we understand or we see or we sense. And at the same time, it's a process where you kind of move into more skill or more inhabiting or more. It's both and somehow. It's always there and it can always be evoked in its totality. But like owning it really deeply over time is also a process, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Louis, this is interesting also from an educational perspective. Because what is then the educational strategy here? Because it's highly focused on the dormant qualities of the individual. But is this a social thing? Is this a social practice? Because often in sustainability, for example, it's always about linking the individual to issues that goes beyond the individual, and not necessarily always from the individual. There's huge discussions, of course, because this could seem quite radical, what you're presenting here, especially in the constant belonging form, that this is basically a revolution you're talking about. But is it a revolution from within, from the individual? How does this work?
I think I'm inspired by Guitaris' three ecologies as an operational framework to understand what's going on for participants. And you know, the three ecologies is the mental, the social, and the environmental ecology. So the mental ecology is the self. It's like, it's understanding the profound interconnectedness of everything in me, and developing my mental ecology. But the social ecology is relational, completely relational. So that's where I understand that I'm completely connected to the person. The social ecology, that's humans, you know? So it's connectedness between humans. And so that's completely human relational and dependent on that. And the environmental ecology is then understanding the profound interconnectivity of everything, actually in its most potent form, that like really realizing that everything is made of stardust. So it doesn't make sense to separate anything, because it's all made of the same matter ultimately. And these three understandings are completely intertwined. So I think it's both a mental, a social, and an environmental, if we use that conceptual framework. It's all of them at the same time, and they're intertwined. And I think in my understanding, and when I read the notebooks from the participants. Different participants have different entry points. So for some, it really starts in the social. It starts in the relational. It's like they open up through that, through connecting to other people in a different way. And for some, it starts with themselves and understanding and realizing internal processes or something in their mind. And for some, it starts with the kind of cosmic connectivity, you know? So, and this is just one, of course, conceptual framework, but it's helpful also in response to your reflection, I think, that to also to kind of illustrate that it's all of them. It's all of them. And I don't think one of them comes first. And I think one kind of evokes the others. So let's say for some, it starts in the relational. That's where it kind of the key is, that it's me relating to another human in a new way. For others, it's me relating to a plant in a new way. And, you know, and for others, it's me understanding myself in a new way. But it's also all three for everyone. It's just the key is in different places. And maybe it's in a next place the next time. It just happened that way because they met a special person. So it starts in the social, you know. And so it's completely intertwined. And also for Guitari, I think he says that we need spaces for new social ecologies. Like we need spaces where we can be together in a new way. So it's the relational to evoke and to train new mental ecologies so that we can train to ultimately evoke a new environmental ecology. So they are interconnected. And it's also in my experience what I see in Sisters Academy. And I also see that some tends to like seek out other people more and others tend to withdraw and be themselves. So it's, yeah, I think we're different. And I think it's maybe too reductional to say it's one or the other.
Thank you, Kui. This is super interesting. And it is also something different. I mean, it's working within also the formal educational system and perspectives on competences and so on and so forth. I think we're caught up in, even if we want to rebel and do something new, we're caught up in structures that are not very, you know, flexible or open for discussing these things. So one thing you constantly refer back to and something that you constantly work with is, of course, aesthetics and the importance of aesthetics and your work, the publications and also your communications and so on is really missed in this. So why all this focus on aesthetics through all your work, not only your interventions?
It's because, okay, so first, just to clarify, so I understand aesthetics in the Baumgarten sense of the word as a sensuous experience of the world, which was, so not style or form, as it is often interpreted today in many contexts. From a very... Actually, on a personal level, from a very early age, I realized that this space is really, really, on one hand, it's under-prioritized. Like the cultural ministry is like the absolute lowest in the ministerial hierarchy. And on the other hand, we have this celebration of the art genius and the artist as someone with a very special transcending intelligence. So there's this aesthetic paradox where you also don't easily get access to the aesthetic dimension because it's only for the chosen few in a way. So there is this weird paradox where on the one hand we really celebrate it and it's exclusive, and the other hand it doesn't really have an impact outside. And I think both are problematic because in my own practice I have experienced how valuable it is from a formative perspective, like how much I personally grew as a human being through aesthetic practices, and then also believing this and beginning to create spaces for others to get access, since the access is quite exclusive, seeing in really like the vast majority of participants how much longing there is and how much this like desire there is and how much it healed. If we also dare to talk about spaces for healing, you know, spaces of healing, how much it kind of healed participants, as if, as I write in The Sensuous Society, it's like moving through society with an arm cut off without noticing the blood floating from the armpit. that's what it's like not to have access to that dimension, because it's an integral human dimension that is now isolated in the art system. And I find that's extremely problematic. So that's why I want to democratize the sensuous and poetic. And this is why it runs through everything, because it's the core intention. And then, you know, the in a way now when I look at ecology, that's interesting to see, okay, does this? So if we evoke the aesthetic dimension, it stimulates an ecological awareness. It also does a lot of other very constructive things that I'm sure different researchers have looked at, or that I know different researchers have looked at. So there is so much, to get from evoking the aesthetic dimension more in everyday life that is simply not done. That is not done. And that is my, it runs through my practice. It runs through my research to argue the necessity to do this. Yeah.
I think we have gone quite far. Maybe we, instead of continuing with the questions we already had, maybe we put it the other way around, that we start now a little bit more of a dialogue where you also could have the opportunities to ask some questions regarding your reading of our works on what we have discussed so far, that we enter the stage of dialogue a little bit more.
Yeah, but I'm actually quite curious to hear you unfold because I'm really interested in vulnerability and when we are vulnerable and what does that means. And you have this pedagogy of vulnerability. So I wanted to know if you could unfold that a bit, and maybe then we could talk about some links between that and sensuous learning, because I think there are some links between those two positions.
The point of vulnerability maybe relates a little bit also where we do not converge, but there might also be differences with regards, for example, to the what kind of outlook we take on learning, because in dark pedagogy, I ground the notion of vulnerability quite a lot in the notion of death, and I take this death as maybe not an orthodox reading, but a little bit of a appropriation of the notion of death, being towards death, as put forward by Heidegger. And Heidegger has this idea of that actually when you're in the world, you're not really yourself fully, in that sense that you're always already caught up in relations and so on. So it's almost that as you are translated by the world, but you're, and then he puts forward the idea of death both as a possibility and the limit of existence. So in that sense, if you could not die, you could not exist. So that is a possibility, but it's also the limit of your existence. So once you die, your existence is gone. And then he puts forward the idea that at the moment of death, you have arrived at your own most. So you have arrived at yourself in that sense. So. And vulnerability and the pedagogy of vulnerability is maybe different from a process-oriented outlook like Deleuzian or the relational outlook, that it is not focused on the primary on the relationality, but on a future self, which I call it. So it's a self at the state of death. Which is not like in the classical sense, like in pedagogical thought, where you, what you are is already internally given in the past. It's not your genes. It's not where you come from. It's not that. But it's the self at the moment of death, which is not decided yet. So in that sense, is a pedagogy of vulnerability engages with both that openness of the self, that what you become, and is also this. Allowing yourself to be heard. I think that's where the aesthetic, I think we have a similar notion of aesthetic, is because it's what you will be takes place not on the inside, but on an aesthetic level, when the self encounters other selves in that sense. So, and that encounter, the aesthetic encounter, will shape what you will become. So it's a realization in that sense also of the future self. And I think there also where you were pointing out that experience of a longing, which I think is a longing of coming from a future. So it's a future of let's take the example, the case of falling deeply in love. When you're falling deeply in love, it's not that often that you cannot say, oh, now I felt in love, you know what I mean? But when you feel that you're falling in love, is that you, it feels like you always have been in love, you know, and that relates then to the idea is that it's almost like when you were supposed to encounter that other entity, which you have a deeply aesthetical experience with, is like as if it would been installed, that it was supposed to be happening, but not from a past, from a future. So in that sense, is vulnerability and the pedagogy of vulnerability, I think it's similar to what you are trying to do. And the sensuousness is that vulnerability allows yourself to become sensuous, right? Because quite often when we encounter the harshness of the world, which also Jonas was pointing out, is that we get hurt. You know, we get hurt in the sense that we experience the world hurting us, but also that what we encounter about ourselves is not something that we want to acknowledge, right? It's, I cannot be that. I do not want to be that. But then pedagogy of vulnerability accustoms itself to allowing yourself to feel I am that, in that sense, and that the fulfillment of that education project is at the time of death.
And if I can just add to that, I think the whole point also you point towards it, Kui, that you do not name what is going on, you do not deliver any fixed results. And I think also this is something that's withdrawn. I mean, it's also something that we're drawing from speculative realism and other places, that this is constantly, you know, out of reach. This is something that we feel, and notions of future self, I think, is an excellent way of describing this, that we do not have access to this, but it's very much relating to the lives that we live, and very much something that's constantly present, but we have no complete access.
I think this is really, really interesting in terms of a conceptual pair that I haven't talked about yet. It's one that I developed in 2015 when we were performing in Sweden, but it could have been anywhere. It's from observing different participatory positions in Sisters Academy. So different people who come in and position themselves differently, you know, as audience participants or visiting artists, teachers, and researchers. And I call them the critical gaze and the devoted body. The critical gaze and the devoted body. So it's like they are in relation to each other, and the participatory positions contain both. You have those who stand at a critical distance and look and observe what's going on. And then you have the devoted bodies who take that leap of faith and surrender and say, okay, I devote myself to this experiment for the next 24 hours or what, and I do it. I choose devotion. And then there is, of course, everything in between. And it's really important for me to say that we don't celebrate dualism. So it's not like one on top of the other. Like I really, in my practice, I really, really celebrate intertwinement of reflection and experience. And I believe the experience evokes deeper reflection, and that reflectivity evokes stronger experiences and wider and longer experiences. But nevertheless, it's helpful to understand these different participatory positions. But what I have observed is that the critical gaze is quite trained in our part of the world, and it's also a quite safe position. It's quite safe to stand outside and critically look at what's going on, and it takes much more courage to choose to be the devoted body. So it's a much more courageous act. And therefore, the devoted body is also the vulnerable body, especially when you also have critical gazing in the room, which we do in our work, because we don't demand how people are there. They can be there as with a critical gaze or a devoted body. So since we don't orchestrate that, both will be present in the same room, which kind of requires for the devoted body to be a very courageous body and thus also becomes a very vulnerable body. So I find myself as the artistic director wanting to protect the devoted bodies, or for this framework to be a framework that also protects that leap of courage. And it's interesting also this thing that you said, Jonas, about that you don't necessarily name what's going on or provide results, because in some of the material, again, these notebooks that I studied, some devoted bodies, a lot actually in Sisters Academy, are able to express themselves, but it's also the bodies that are not able to express themselves. So the notebooks are left empty because I just know this person was really, really engaged, but there's nothing in her notebook. And that's kind of interesting in terms of research, because how do you get, like, how can I say that it was a very deep process for her because her notebook is empty, because she was not concerned with delivering results? Or, as I say, it's not the case anytime, but it, where the critical gaze has a lot of words, and they stand and they observe and they describe. So in a way, you know, there is something there in the reading of the material when you validate an experience, or when you have to, how valuable was it, or what did it create, or what did it generate? Where it's even though this kind of way that we produce data or generate material is so sensuous, that's still not sufficient when it comes to the complete devotion or the vulnerability of the devoted body.
If I might, I think that there's something really there, and I think also that what I could comment on from a dark pedagogic perspective is also that maybe the devoted body is the passionate body. Where I think I was thinking of the book Submission by Michel Houellebecq, where to some extent he's the critical, cynical professor in the beginning, but then in the act of submission, as in rendering vulnerable, he finds passion again, like, you know, because he almost clinically depressed in the beginning, but then in the act of submission, of rendering yourself vulnerable, is that you find a passion as a form of quality of life again. And like this, and I think to turn it a bit dark, that in German, passion is also this Leidenschaft, you know, because you have the Leiden, which is the suffering. So even, you know, which comes back to this willingness of the teacher, of the pedagogue, to protect the. You engage with the devoted body despite you knowing that there will be suffering involved. So it is, you know, this double-sidedness of knowing that there will be suffering, but also there's this passion and this willingness involved.
If I can add to that, our in dark pedagogy, we have this continuum between denial, insanity, death. And it's something that we draw from Lovecraft by reading his novels, where people encountering things, monsters, intrusions by a strange light from outer space, they behave in certain ways. They react. So they deny what's going on. They accept it. And thus they become insane from the general public. Or they die. And we've written chapters based on that. But then we got a critique that there's also a fourth position. That there's the... In his, I mean, he's Lovecraft, not a necessarily nice guy, and also had lots of racist attitudes and so on that we do not like. But he talked about the savages, you know, that jumped in and became the devoted bodies. You know, that just when the monstrous entities came from the sea, then they worshipped it. They went with the flow, and we didn't really incorporate that into the book. Perhaps we couldn't really manage it. But there is something about this, I mean, following and also the bodies as something that we have a hard time setting free, also in our culture, but also in an educational perspective, something that's always on the fringe and something we have a very hard time measuring and, you know, putting into competencies and so on.
Yeah, but it's also, it relates a bit to when you talked about transformation as manipulation, with the savages who surrender in a way or devote themselves. Because I think the critical gaze, okay, the reason when I see critical gazes gazing at the practice of Sisters Hope, the argument is very often that it's potentially, you know, seductive. And there is a fear of that fear of seduction. And I think also in, like, if we just narrow it down to a European context, You know, we've had seen terrible examples of mass seduction the last centuries. So it's very integrated in us that we need to really, really, really train and evolve our critical gaze to never allow such a situation to happen again. And so in a way, we've trained it so much so that it comes with a cost in a way. We have kind of, we have sacrificed our ability of devotion because we have trained our criticality so much to allow this, make sure disasters don't, or mass seduction, disastrous mass seductions won't happen again. But I'm a little bit interested in the sacrifice of devotion, or, you know, what we miss out on, like what has the critical gaze sacrificed? And that's why, of course, it's not about sacrificing criticality. And we've trained that it's beautiful. We should be even more critical, that it's part of our educational formative process for all people to develop that ability to see through things. But at the same time, it would be beautiful if that training could continue without sacrificing the ability of devotion. And not necessarily seeing it as something very, very, as a very dangerous, seductive pool, not necessarily translating all practices that asks for devotion, not necessarily translating that into seductive pools that will be disastrous, because they want, many of them offer spaces of healing. So, you know, we need that in our we need to develop our criticality to see distinct between these things and to understand when something is a space for healing and when it's not. And, you know, we need to develop that. We need to nuance it, refine it, be more clever, more wise, you know. Otherwise, what we lose is too much. It's too much. And that's why this big longing, I think, and that's also at the root of the ecological crisis, ironically, because we are so disconnected from connectedness. We are so disconnected from the scientific fact that everything is made of star dots. It's not a new age subtitle, subheading. We love science and it's a scientific fact. So, and even though it's that, we don't consider it in everyday life at all. And, you know, and I really think the aesthetics or some leaps of devotion, because connectedness require devotion. You cannot truly connect to another human, for example, or to your natural environment without devoting yourself a little bit. You cannot. So, you know, the ultimate sacrifice is that. It's that we are just completely alone, every one of us. And that will cause ecological disaster. So it might prevent like mass seduction movement, but then it creates ecological disaster. You know, so there's something there we really need to... I think it's time to train that now. We trained the other a lot. We need to nuance it at least. Yeah.
Thank you, Gry. Yeah. I mean, we could be at this for hours. I mean, it's super interesting, but we also have to wrap it up somehow. So where are you going from now? I mean, it's been a strange spring for all of us, but you've gone from having a small art project to now also being recognized as an official part of Denmark and a cultural asset and so on. So where do you see yourself moving, not only yourself, but also Sisters Academy?
Yeah, that's so, because talking about vulnerability, my body is as vulnerable, even though it gets recognition, because we continuously move on the border of things. And every time, and when you work interventionist, every time we go into a new context, very few people know who we are when we come there and we do our things. So I think it's a long time before it's just safe spaces, before the world is just like a series of safe spaces for us. So I think in that way, it's kind of just a continuation of what we've done already. And also when we go abroad, again, we are new and we will evoke, I'm sure, the same kind of fear of the unknown, which we always represent. And so we continue to do that. And from, I have defined this as a lifetime project, and I'm very serious. And that gives me kind of a sense of, it gives me a sense of just patience, a patience to continuously expand this these spaces of maneuverability based on the sensuous and the poetic, and to insist on the hopeful activities of ongoingness. So it's, it's very much the same. It doesn't feel like I'm safer now. It really doesn't. I was thinking about that when I heard your question. Am I safer now? No.
Work to be done, but stubbornly hopeful. I think that's a good position to be in.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Gry, for participating in this, and let's continue the collaboration and thinking together. There's a lot we can learn from each other. So, yeah, thank you for participating in this.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.